Grafton High School will soon be playing its home basketball and volleyball games inside the Acuity Gymnasium. It's not a high-end special facility in the community. It's the same gym as before, but it now has a corporate sponsor. The Grafton School Board recently signed off on a 25-year agreement with Acuity Insurance worth $425,000. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported this week that other school districts in southeastern Wisconsin have or are considering naming rights for school buildings, areas, facilities, and other property, though only a few have actually pursued such deals. Marguerite Rosa is the director of the Edunomics Lab and a research associate professor at Georgetown University. She specializes in school finance and spending. Marguerite, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this issue of various kinds of corporate sponsorship in schools, it's not a new idea, is it?
No, it's definitely not a new idea, and it's not unique to school districts. We see municipalities, higher education institutions, cities, counties doing the same kind of thing.
There's been extra concern when it comes to schools, though, because it's kids potentially being advertised to. What kind of objections do people often bring up when it comes to corporate sponsorships of facilities?
Well, I think the real objections come around if the advertising to kids is designed to get them the kids to start consuming a product more. So we saw this a lot. The discussion came up a lot around 20 years ago when fast food or, you know, sodas or things that kids would consume were advertised to them on the sides of school buses. And we generally don't see that anymore. I think the consensus is that if we're trying to sell something to the kids, then it doesn't belong in schools. There is a lot of naming of facilities that happens, and often with a local community partner who's trying to oftentimes, you know, do good by the way of the public schools and contribute in some way and be recognized for their contribution. I think we see a lot of that.
So in the one example we mentioned in a school here in Wisconsin, it's an insurance company. Presumably the high school kids aren't going to be flocking out of school to sign up for a policy.
Right, right. And in fact, when it's a local company, a lot of times that you have employees of the company who have spouses, sisters, brothers, et cetera, that are employed in the schools and kids of employees that are in the schools. And the idea is they're trying to be a local partner there. That is what we typically see when we see these kinds of things.
Around the country, are you seeing school districts turning to some form of naming rights or sponsorships as a way of coping with concerns about funding shortfalls or reduced funding from their state governments?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we're not seeing any more of a jump in that than any other time. I think it's, like I said, it's not unusual for districts to get creative. For years, we've seen districts sometimes charge fees for kids for lockers or seek some kinds of donations or auctions or have volunteers or partnerships or booster clubs or sponsors of uniforms, you name it, to kind of try to bring in some money on the margin. And it's generally money on the margin. You know, the school districts are spending somewhere in the neighborhood of $12,000 to $14,000 per pupil. And these kinds of arrangements, if you look at them, bring in, and you know, basically change compared to that. And in view, the Acuity example, you mentioned a $425,000 contribution over 25 years. If you divide it out per pupil during the time of the gym, you're at $24 per student. And that is something that is relatively minimal compared to the $12,000 to $14,000 in public funds that the district is spending on behalf of the students.
Talking to Marguerite Rosa from the Edunomics Lab and research associate professor at Georgetown University, talking about corporate sponsorships and schools, naming rights, and more. Do you often see it as a particular facility? The school has one substantial capital project, maybe a new sports facility or gym or something like that, that tends to get this kind of sponsorship?
Yes, it can be more in the nice to have kind of things. And the Acuity example is part of their capital plan. We see a lot of sponsors of the scoreboard at athletic facilities. That's so common across the country. And like a score, you know, a big electronic scoreboard might be a nice to have kind of item. We see places where, you know, the track field might be in not great condition, and yet it's not critical that it be replaced in a given year, and you might get a sponsor that does that. So those are the things. And we would recommend that if you are going to partner with an outside source of fund, a community source, that it be for a one-time or a capital expense versus a non-recurring expense, in part because, you know, you really can never count on that going forward. So you leave the public funds to do the operating costs and, you know, do bonds and other kinds of levies or community contributions to build the permanent structures.
And do you have recommendations for schools about screening the kinds of businesses who might do a sponsorship? This might be okay for a school setting. This other one might not be.
Well, we would suggest to engage with the community and be really transparent about that. You know, you want to put the contribution in per pupil terms to sort of figure out what amount of money are we talking about here? What, if anything, is asked in return? And then engage with the community and be really transparent about that. Like I said, one-time cost, non-recurring costs are better than trying to figure out how to support operating costs with these sort of partnerships. And generally, I think the standard is to avoid advertising directly to students. You don't want to have, you know, Red Bull or junk food or something like that in the cafeteria that's trying to encourage students to consume products. And the more local, probably the better, because these local partnerships, these local investments and arrangements with communities do well for schools. I think not just in terms of bringing money, but in terms of those community relationships and those, you know, schooling is a human business, right? It's very much about these relationships. It's less transactional than many other industries. And having community industries partner with schools tends to bring goodwill all around.
Now, how about in-kind corporate support? We're going to provide you with these materials for use in the classroom or technology or what have you. The students get to use it for free. Oh, but it's got our logo on it.
Yeah, I mean, again, I guess the question is, are you trying to sell a product that, you know, in the near term? But this can happen in all sorts of forms. You could see Apple computers discounting the cost of computers to schools, thinking, well, if the kids are using Apples, you know, when they're in elementary school, maybe they'll keep using them for their whole life. And so that happens in lots of ways like that. I don't think you can buy a computer without a logo on it anyway. So I think that can happen. Again, if there are donations or contributions made, I think they should absolutely be on the up and up and very, very much communicated. What's one of the things we find is that school districts don't always do a great job about engaging with their public when it comes to money. We teach about that in our certificate program at Georgetown, how to build those skills. But the more communication, the more likely you are to have trust. And if there is some sensitivity around it, that'll come out when you're having very open discussions with your community about potential revenue sources.
We're talking about corporate sponsorship at K-12 schools with Marguerite Rosa. She's director of the Edunomics Lab and a research associate professor at Georgetown University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of selling the naming rights for certain school facilities, maybe the football field, the gym, what have you, to local businesses? How about non-local businesses? Is it a good way for schools to help pay for projects like that? Or do you think it sends a bad message to kids? Where do you draw the line? What works for you? What doesn't? And what do you see in your community when you go into the school? When you go to the football game, basketball game, what do you see? Are you cool with it or does something bug you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about corporate sponsorships at schools. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that a few public schools in southeastern Wisconsin have pursued such agreements, and others are looking into the idea as a way in particular to fund facility projects. Well, what do you think of this? Call in at 800-642-1234. Is there a place for business sponsorships in K-12 schools or not? If you're a school official yourself, is this an issue on your radar? Is this something that you've done to help do some kind of capital improvement? If you're a business owner, would you consider buying naming rights to a school facility in your area? And where do you draw the line? If you're a parent or a community member, what would be appropriate for a school? What is not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Well, on our Facebook page, we heard from a former state lawmaker, Therese Brousseau. She writes, "No to school sponsorships. We shouldn't teach that making money is the definition of success." And Marguerite, there are people out there who think, you know, no slippery slope here. We don't want any corporate sponsorship, business sponsorship in the schools. Is that a common sentiment across the country?
No, that isn't. I think in most communities, especially that might be common in more urban areas. But in many communities, you know, there are senses for the schools to maintain a really good relationship with their community. Next time there's some sort of bond initiative and the community votes on that, maybe we're trying to replace the roof on the main school or things like that. We want people to vote yes on those. And so we're not trying to be at odds, generally speaking, with local industries. Local industries often hire graduates, come in and volunteer in classrooms, teach classes and things like that. So I think the idea of you know, setting up a barrier wall and not recognizing the real human connections there might be to a school district's detriment. At the same time, I would say that there's not as much money here as most people think. Mm-hmm. I mean, I, the numbers can sound big, but when you're looking over the long haul, these are really small dollar amounts per pupil per year. And so if you're setting up your district to spend a ton of time with the staff trying to recruit these allocations, that may not be a good use of your time. Because they tend to be very small.
Let's bring on a caller now. Luke is with us in Milwaukee. Luke, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you think about this?
Well, I'm more of the opinion if the direct beneficiaries of this would be the taxpayers that are paying for the kids to go to these schools, then by all means advertise as much as you want, as long as it gets kicked back to us.
Luke, thanks for the call. Again, it's not a lot of money being kicked back to taxpayers, but does this tend to relieve, in a place like Wisconsin, say, the property tax burden, Marguerite?
Generally not. I mean, the way it can happen is that a local initiative fails, so the voters vote no, and there's sort of a coming back to what is the minimum thing we need, or where can we try to work with community partners to get an industry contribution or sponsorship of something, and that allows us to not have to go back to our voters. So that can be an issue, but a lot of times capital improvements do fail at the ballot box, and you know they're just put off for a few years. So maybe we're not going to redo the stadium right now, or we're not going to spruce up the gym. We're going to go another 2 or 3 years until the local economy turns around and people feel more inclined to vote yes. So I think though they're, you know, the relationship isn't a 1-to-1 with the dollars, and sometimes they'll just dip into the operating expenses, sort of the $12,000 to $14,000 that do come from public sources that are operating. You know, maybe we'll figure out how we can replace the roof with those dollars.
Luke, thanks a lot for the call. Marguerite, have you run into school districts who think, given the limited amount of money involved, it may not be worth the effort to pursue these kind of deals?
Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes there's you see the big number and then you haven't sort of realized that how big the rest of the district's budget is, and maybe this isn't worth our time. Like I said, a lot of this is about relationships with community and where school districts are thinking and working about those relationships or trying to ensure that they're being also a responsible partner in their community. And that way, when things go to the ballot, people tend to vote yes on them. They feel like their district has been listening to them. And so I think we see a lot of that. But I don't think most district people think this is where the big money's coming from.
Setting aside the sponsorship, I want to hear more about community engagement in the schools. What are some of the recommendations you would have a school who hasn't had that community engagement mindset up to date?
Well, we've done actually a lot of research with some other partners on that issue. And one of the things we find over and over is that people want the chance to weigh in on how public funds are spent. And having a lot of communication and an opportunity and an authentic invitation to weigh in is a really good way to build trust with the community. And a lot of times school district leaders just don't quite have the skills to do that, or may not have had the practice, and might feel like it's extraneous. It's an extra burden that we have to put put on ourselves, but it goes a long way, both with the community, but also with those in the schools. And we find that principals and teachers and parents and the larger community all want to weigh in and participate in conversations about how resources are allocated.
And I think some administrators might hear that and think, great, people get to yell at me more at school board meetings. What's a way to set up a good positive environment to do that?
Well, first of all, not letting them weigh in is a great way to get more yelling. So I think if they feel like they're not heard, that's going to happen. When we teach on this, as I mentioned in our certificate at Georgetown on ed finance, and spend a lot of time sort of going over the research with folks that shows that if you're not invited to weigh in, the public is more likely to respond with anger. So the trust gets higher when there are more opportunities for this. And a lot more empathy comes if the district says, look, these are tough decisions. We've been trying to decide if we spend our money on X or Y, and here's the dollars that we have at hand, and these are limited resources, and we want to hear from the community about what matters most. And as we make our decisions, we want to hear from you all on how this plays out. And that kind of dialogue goes a long way to encourage trust in local school districts.
We'll leave it there for now, Marguerite. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Marguerite Rosa, director of the Edunomics Lab and a research associate professor at Georgetown University. She specializes in school finance and spending. We talked to her about school districts considering and in some cases turning to corporate sponsorships to help pay for projects and other items on their budgets. No one wants to be hungover, especially when they have to work. The most recent study available shows excessive drinking cost Wisconsin $6.8 billion in 2012. More than 40% of that was due to lost productivity. Danielle Kading reports on the challenges that workers and employers face when alcohol becomes a problem on the job.
Pastry chef Noreen Ovadia-Wills makes great food. She found out early on she could even do it while drinking when she worked for the owner of a bar and restaurant on Lake Superior's Madeline Island.
And he kept feeding me Bloody Marys, and I was really drunk. He's like, get back in there and cook. And I'm like, I can't. I'm too drunk. He goes, I can cook so drunk that I can't even stand up. Get in the kitchen.
Not every boss was like that, but Will says that was just part of restaurant culture. Work hard, get really sweaty, and go out drinking afterwards. She says she worked in every single restaurant on the island before her drinking made her unemployable. Now the recovering alcoholic owns a cafe in Washburn with her husband.
Order up!
It's been a long road to recovery for Wills. She recalls missing shifts, getting arrested several times, and losing custody of her daughter for a time. She says everything was about getting that next drink.
Barely struggling to get to work so that you can have money so you can feed your addiction is your main focus.
A 2015 national report shows the food service industry is among the top three with the highest rates of heavy alcohol use next to mining and construction. Dr. George Kube with the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism says it's no surprise excessive drinking can lead to problems on the job.
It doesn't take much of an imagination to realize that contributes to injuries, fatalities, absenteeism, hangovers. You're not at your best, so you're slower to work. You make more mistakes.
That's led some companies to offer programs to help employees struggling with alcohol. University of Georgia sociology professor Paul Roman says the foundation of those employee assistance programs is to improve their job performance.
Lots and lots of workers, male and female, the job is really central to their identity. And it may be enough of a shock or wake-up call that they're letting their behavior become sloppy and that they don't need to go to treatment.
Roman says employee assistance programs have great potential to help workers, but he questions whether they're effective for addressing alcohol. He says a lot of programs are provided by outside vendors that give people an 800 number to call where they may be referred to a handful of free counseling sessions.
If that isn't adequate, then they supposedly have to start paying these counselors if they want to get any more treatment. And that's it. That's all there is.
Marina London with the Employee Assistance Professional Association argues a good program has behavioral health professionals who provide confidential services to help connect people with the resources they need. But she says employers don't always do a good job letting people know help is available.
The
the company has to be behind the program. The program has to be of quality, and the employee has to be brave enough to ask for the help. And it takes courage to ask for help.
London says some may shy away from seeking help because of the stigma associated with substance abuse. Others may fear backlash from their employer or may not have health insurance. Noreen Ovadia-Wills says it never occurred to her to ask an employer for help because she wasn't ready to admit she needed it.
It helps to know where you can go for help when you need it. Doesn't mean you're going to get it. You know, I mean, it doesn't mean you're going to ask for it.
When Wills did reach out for help, it wasn't easy. She went to detox more than a dozen times and began going to recovery meetings. But now, Wills has gone from being unemployable to hiring others looking for a second chance. She's even driven employees to detox herself. She says it may seem crazy, but someone was crazy enough to give her a chance. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Find out more in our series, High Tolerance, looking at alcohol in Wisconsin. You can find all of our stories there at WPR.org/alcohol. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a bunch of other stuff in Congress. While the standoff between the president and House Democrats is getting headlines, we'll look at a long list of policy items on the table in the Senate and the House. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll talk to the author of the new cookbook, Indian-ish, about capturing the feel of Indian food, but not stressing out over getting all the details just right. And we'll meet two Wisconsin students going to a national spelling bee. Can they spell excited? I hope so, because that's a pretty easy word compared to a lot of the words they'll run into in a big spelling bee. Plus, we'll round up some of the most interesting stories from communities around Wisconsin. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.